Okay. Hopefully the phone will record well. Okay. Hope it'll work. Welcome back from your breaks, your travels, if there were travels, experiences of warmer climates, if they were warmer climates. It wasn't bad here. The truth of the matter is. But I welcome us back to Yeshaya Perek Chavav, chapter 26, and I really could have used a more hospitable chapter to come back to. Wow, this one is a hard, hard parak. This is a hard chapter. Remember that we are now in what you could consider really the third unit of the book, skipping the question of chapter 1, right? Ignoring chapter 1. The fourth unit of the book. Right, the first unit was Prakim Bet Tavav, chapters 2-6, and that was the era of wealth in the time of Uzziyahu. We're actually going to come back to that era in chapter, I think it's 27 or 28. We're going to come back to talk about that. But that was the one period. Then you had the second era. The second period was chapter 7-12, when Yeshayahu tries to warn King Ahaz not to join the Assyrians and not to join Yisrael and Aram in their alliances. And then you had the third unit, which was the one we spent the bulk of our time on this year, which was the set of prophecies against the 10 enemies from the region, 9 nations, plus this fellow Shevna in Yerushalayim. And then we started on the fourth unit, which is chapters 24-27, which speak about a far off in the future, apparently far off in the future, fall of the Jewish people and then rising of the Jewish people. And in chapter 24, I gave you a little reminder note at the top of the sheet. Chapter 24 had a prediction of destruction, ending with the darkening of the sun and the moon. And there were 3 different ways to take that narrative, in terms of when it takes place and who exactly is going to suffer. We had the view of Rashi that it's about the Jews suffering and then ultimately coming to a geula, to a redemption. You had the Malbim who talked about it being a period of suffering before the Assyrian invasion and then the Yehuda, Judea, being saved from the Assyrians and then suffering again in the future and then rising again after that in the time of Mashiach. But sort of this wave of things in the future, not the way that Rashi took it, which is it's just about suffering in the time right before Mashiach and then Geulah and then redemption, but a whole up and down through our history. And then you had the view of Radak and Abarbanel who said, no, it wasn't about us falling at all. It's about the enemies falling in the time of Mashiach before Tchiyat HaMeitim, the resurrection of the dead. There was the image of the future darkening of the moon and the sun, which we took maybe as being about either the nations or the idols that they worship. And we had the song, the Tzvila Tzadik, the song that we hear from the ends of the earth, and maybe that's a song about Chizkiyahu. That was all chapter 24, so you don't need to know that. It's just, I figured I would just mention it in case it rung a bell. Then we had Perek Chaf Hei, we had chapter 25, which predicted the downfall of our enemies and possibly the end of death. And right in the middle of that chapter, we had the big feast, right? You remember this business with the big feast? So we didn't know what to make of the image of a big feast. It seems to be inviting the nations to join in. And we didn't understand that. We didn't understand what was being served either, because you had this business of the wine with the sediment and and the refined oil. So we ended up saying either the basic approach that almost everyone takes to this feast, and that it was a feast that is used as an instrument of the downfall of our foes, whether that means a literal feast and they eat and they're full and they're heavy and they can't fight, or whether it meant something else. We talked about I'm not going through all the different layers. Or Abarbanel's view that it was actually, no, it's a feast referring to the rewards and punishments that God is going to mete out, again, at the time of Tchiyat HaMeitim, the resurrection of the dead. But the theme here, very clearly in these two chapters, is a theme of God setting things right with the world. There will come a time when God will put paid to the various outstanding receipts that bless you, that that various nations have, and that's a theme that continues, bless you, within our chapter, chapter 26, Perek Chaf Vav. This was such a hard chapter to work with. I hope people did get a chance to look at it in advance. I know that some people have told me that they did, which is good. You know, it's funny, because the Hebrew is rough and it's not rough. It's not rough in the sense that there are no words here that defy translation. Meaning in other chapters, there are words that you just look at and say, what does that word mean? But they don't hold together.
They don't hold meaning. They make...
Right, like the sentences don't seem to work within themselves, and then how one sentence leads into the next. I tried in number one there, source number one, I tried to give you some sense of structure, but you can even see in there... What's your structure? A call to Jerusalem to welcome us in, a sentence that I don't know what to do with, in sentence three.
Tikbolet, how do you say?
Tikbolet, parallelism. There's a lot of neat use of language. Yeah. He uses shachar and layla. He uses, yeah. There's a lot of that. You know, it's just, the whole thing is very hard to work with. And so that gave me the idea that I would join you in with my suffering. And me, you know, Imo Anochi Betzara. So what I thought you would do, and yeah, it's a fast day, so why not? But what I thought I would do is try to show you an approach to tackling a chapter like this. What do you do when you hit a chapter like this? Sorry?
I thought it was easier than some of the chapters.
Really? Okay.
I don't know.
And I read it in English and didn't understand it.
Well, that's the thing. But that's exactly my point. Joyce's point is exactly my point. She read it in English and had the same problem because things just don't hold together. There isn't a clear flow. That's my first weapon when I approach a chapter and I want to understand what's going on is just to try to outline it. And I couldn't. First you're here, then you're there. I don't know who you're talking to here, but you're not talking to them in the next sentence. The voices change. It's a very hard parak to work with. So here's what I can say. The overall theme of Schar Va'onish, of reward and punishment for the nations, very much continues here from chapters 24 and 25. That's number one. Number two, there is clearly a long digression in the middle about our loyalty to God during the period of our suffering. Why it's there and what it's doing is subject to debate, and that's going to be the major debate in how to read our chapter. But he talks about how we were under these foreign masters, and yet we were loyal to God. At the end, there's a prediction of shalom, and of Tchiyat HaMeitim, again, the resurrection of the dead, as a major piece within these chapters. These events, according to almost all commentators, are predicted for some future date. Only Malbim that I saw said, well, maybe. Take a look at number two. I brought you Malbim's line. He says, when it says, Bayom Hahu, on that day, Hi Nivu'a Atida, it's a prophecy for the future, O Nitzkama Bimei Chizkiyah. Or it was happened during Chizkiyah's day. I assume he doesn't mean Tchiyat HaMeitim, the resurrection. But the bigger question to me is not when is this about? Because I think it is, like almost every commentator says, this is distant future. Or by now, maybe it's not distant, but to Yeshaya's time it was. But the question of when he received and communicated this message. We've already said, we talked about this last year, Yeshayahu can experience the message anytime and just have it communicated later on. We talked about his students who record some of his messages and pass them on even after he's dead. So it's not as though the experience of it, the receiving of the message, is the same as when it's communicated. But those who read through this, what is the audience that is hearing this? When is this message communicated? Why?
Because of the Passover, Israel is supposed to welcome us.
Right. So one way to look at it is that this is a message for the Jews who return for the second Beit HaMikdash, mm-hmm. long after Yeshaya, obviously. And one argument for it, as you say, is because, after all, these are people, you talk about the beginning of the chapter, calling to Yerushalayim to welcome us in, that's what they're doing. They're coming back and asking Yerushalayim to welcome them in. I would add to that, in agreement, that this can only be addressed to people who have known real suffering. This isn't a message that goes to a nation that, you know, is afraid of something in the future. This is a nation that has suffered. If you take a look, we're on page 995 in the Stone Tanakh. Actually, go on to 997, sorry. If you take a look at sentence 13, right, Pasuk Yud Gimel, in chapter 26. So, you know, the Hebrew, Hashem Elokeinu Be'alunu Adonim Zulatecha, right? Which in English is translated very softly as lords other than you have ruled over us. The term Be'alunu is really stronger than that. It, you know, we've been raped by is really what this is, you know, what this is saying. The if you look at the Psukim Tet Zayin to Yud Chet, 16 to 18, look at this description of the suffering of the Jews, right? Just even with the English. Hashem, in their trouble, they, the Jews, turned to you. They poured out their silent prayer when you reproached them. Like a pregnant woman close to giving birth, she is in travail, she screams in her pangs. So are we before you, Hashem. We have conceived and gone into travail as if we had borne wind, meaning we produced nothing. We didn't actually get anything out of all of that strain. This is a nation that has suffered. I don't think you can have this prophecy any time before Galut Bavel, before the exile in Bavel. The Jews living in their land don't experience anything like this. So that's to me, I agree, it has to be at the earliest in Galut Bavel, in their exile in Bavel, if not later, that they're hearing this message. It doesn't, otherwise it would have no meaning to them. Okay. I gave you questions for preparation. Louise, that was a great idea. No, I'm serious. It was a great idea. I'm enjoying doing that. It's good for me, and I heard on the way in that it's good for others as well. Okay. So as I said in the beginning, for those who missed the first minutes, what I want to talk about is how you approach a chapter like this, and in the course of it, we'll learn the chapter. But I want to try to present a method for how one deals with this. So the challenge of reading a chapter like this is, you know, as I said, I like to look for structure first, and here it's really difficult. It's difficult also, not just because the sentences don't seem to lead to each other, but also the way that the chapter works physically. If you take a look in the Stone Tanakh, do they give this? Yeah, they do. They show, you see the breaks in between paragraphs? So your chapter begins on 994, really, because you have to see it in the Hebrew. The English won't show it to you. But you see you have a long block of text from sentence 1 to 10. Then sentence 11 is actually a standalone. They don't break it up that way here. They don't give you the gap after sentence 11, but in my edition, they do. There's a pause, there's a break after sentence 11. Then you have a long unit from sentences 12 to 19, and then 20 to 21 are standalone. So it's long, short, long, short. It doesn't have that kind of flow you want, and the voices and audiences don't match the units of the physical structure, meaning, if you imagine for yourself a script for a play, right? So the name of the speaker and then the text, the name of the speaker and then the text, and you expect that each new paragraph of script is going to be a different person speaking, potentially addressing the same person or different people. That's not the way it works with these blocks of text here. So that first block, sentences 1 to 10, has parts in it that address us, the Jews, and has parts in it that address Hashem. The second block, chapters 12 to 19, sentences 12 to 19, I should say, sorry, includes parts that address God and parts that might be God addressing us. The voice changes without any cue within the psukim, within the text. And so you say, all right, fine, I can't find a physical structure that works, but maybe thematic structure. But the whole chapter is broken into one and two verse segments. And that makes it hard as well. Not to mention, some of the sentences could be read as questions, or as statements, and the commentators will disagree. So here's what I tried to do with this. And again, maybe it will be useful. I hope it will be useful. Actually, before that, sorry. Before I tell you what I did, I want to show you what Rashi and Abarbanel did, because this is fun. Take a look at source number 4. I like it, and Abarbanel likes it, when Rashi admits he's a human being. He says in number 4, just going with my English translation, but you can see the Hebrew there. He's hitting the middle of the chapter, and he says, I've seen many midrashei agadah, right? Midrash agadah, midrash that tries to explain text that's not halacha. So I've seen many midrashei agadah for the verses of this portion, upper and lower, and I don't know if he means higher medrash and lower medrash, or if he means upper part of the chapter and lower part of the chapter. It's not clear to me. And they do not sit well with the precise language or with the order of the verses. And I have needed to explain it in the way it is structured. He says, I have to work with the text that is in front of me, and therefore I am not going to bring you most of the Midrashim on it, because I just don't see how they fit the text. He's not denying the legitimacy of Midrash, but he's saying it's not going to help me understand the chapter. That's his problem. And so he tells you in this specific case in Pasuk Yud Aleph that he's commenting on sentence 11. If you take a look at the sentence first, it's the bottom of page 994-995. Hashem, he says to God, Rama Yadcha Bal Yechezayun. That is a big problem, what we just read. Rashi notes for you that there are verbs in the Torah that have two syllables, like this Rama, with a kamatz under each syllable, so it's an sound, where the accent is on the first syllable, it has one meaning. Where the accent is on the second syllable, it has another meaning. This is one of those areas where you have to be a good Baal Kriya. You have to know what you're doing when you lane, or you will change the meaning of the sentence and no one will be any the wiser. So for example, the classic example, Rachel comes down to the well. This is always the one that gets quoted, although it also appeared twice in this past week's Parsha, actually. But V'Rachel Ba'a Imatzon Asher Le'Aviha is different from V'Rachel Ba'a Imatzon Asher Le'Aviha. Ba'a, under the first syllable, means it happened already, past tense. Ba'a, under the second syllable, means it is happening right now. And as I said, it comes up a lot in Sefer Bereishit for some reason. You see quite a bit of this. But it happens here. He says, if you say Rama Yadcha, that means your hand was elevated. Rama Yadcha means your hand is elevated. So in neither case is it what some want to take it as, which is a command. Elevate your hand is how some want to read it. So look what Rashi does. He says, there is a Midrash Agadah which says, the prophet is making a request. Rama Yadcha means, raise your hand, God. But and God says to him, God says back to the prophet, better for them to see and be dismayed. The way that the Midrash reads it is that the request from Yeshaya is, God, don't let them see it coming. Raise your hand above human vision. They won't see it. They won't know. And then just strike them. And that God says, no, no, no. Better for them to see it coming. That's the way that the Midrash reads it. And look what Rashi says. He says, this doesn't follow the language. It doesn't say, elevate your hand. That's not what it says. Harima, as you see in the Hebrew. Harima yadcha doesn't say that. Further, even this word, elevate, is different from other words like it. Every use of Yad Rama in Tanakh has the accent below, Rama. Here the accent is above, Rama. In other words, if it were elevated hand, right? Ubnei Yisrael Yotzeim B'Yad Rama from Parashat B'Shalach. So it means an elevated hand. It's a description. Then the accent would be below. It would be Rama. Well, that's different, actually. Never mind that. Here, the accent is Rama, so it's a description of what happened in the past. My point in this is not to torture you with trying to understand Rama here in the sentence, only to show you Rashi's frustration as he tries to explain this, and it isn't consistent with the way the Midrash is doing it. And Rashi says, I have to explain it differently. Take a look now at Abarbanel in number 5. He quotes Urashi, and he says, "In truth, the general exegetical words of the master Rashi are justified along the lines of Midrash Haggadah, but his honor already tried to argue against the Midrashim here, as is appropriate for a commentator who is good and righteous." In other words, he says, you could make Rashi work with it, but he says Rashi chose to go a different route from the Midrash, and he says that's the right things to do. That's the right thing to do. Their words in the Midrash are designed to justify the text. They align their ideas with the text, but as a link, an asmachta, rather than a translation. Therefore, our Holy Master established for us that the drash should be extrapolated, but the text should be made to sit along its simple read. He says, in other words, Midrash has an important role to play. We've talked about this any number of times. Midrash has a great ear for language and will pick up on various things within the language and explain them. However, sometimes you will see that the Midrash has an idea to convey, and they'll link it to the text and not worry so much about how closely it aligns with the grammar. And he says that's what's going on with the Midrashei Agadah here, is that they're not so concerned about the grammar. They're doing it, as he puts it in the Hebrew, al derech haskama, trying to sort of justify it with the text, but not have it really fit. Yes? Right, so often Yeshaya is not beholden to grammar. That is, no, that's true. It's poetry, and it's meant as poetry, and you know, we'll worry about the grammar later. That is also true. Nonetheless, you need to present an argument for how this, in this particular case, would be poetry and why it made sense to do it this way. He's not ignoring grammar willy-nilly. He has reasons for writing roughshod over grammar.
I hope this isn't too heretical, but...
I like sentences that start that way. Yeah?
Okay. Do you ever think, whether you teach it or not, that there could be, that this was not the original text?
So,
corruption and,
right. So, you know, this is the inevitable approach. What Gita points out is the inevitable approach that you read among the critics. They'll look at a text like this and say, clearly this is some kind of damaged blend that ended up here. I have numerous problems, historical problems, not even religious problems, but historical problems with that approach. Starting with the fact that to date, despite the thousands of alternative texts that critics have proposed over the last few centuries, we haven't found any. Not one.
You haven't found any what?
Any of these hypothetical texts that led to where we came to.
Oh,
in other words, there is no alternate version of Yeshaya Perek Chavav out there with a different structure, with pieces of sentences that you know, could have ended up with the mess that we're confronting here today. It's my same problem with Wellhausen and the documentary hypothesis. Show me an E. Show me. I feel like Wheel of Fortune. Give me a document that you know, you have variations between what we have for some of the books of Nach and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'm not claiming that every text of Nach that has ever been found looks the same way that the Stone Tanakh does. But show me somewhere some evidence of the jigsaw puzzle from which this was assembled. That's one problem that I have with it. A second problem that I have with it is you have other texts, the majority of them, that hold together really well. Why is it that here it just got botched? What happened to Yeshaya Perek Chavav that didn't happen to Yeshaya Perek Chav Hei?
Yeah.
Or to Chav Zayin? You know, I find it more, and we said this in Eov at one point also, it wasn't my line, it was, were you with us when we did Eov? I don't think so. So when we read Carol Newsom, the professor from Emory, she was talking about this in terms of some of the rewriting that was done by scholars on the text, and she's not even Jewish. She was not talking about it from a religious perspective. But often it's just laziness that leads to that conclusion, as opposed to any sort of insight. There's more to be said, but I'm going to go back to this. What Abarbanel does with Rashi, if you look at the end of number 5, is Abarbanel, having quoted Rashi and having praised Rashi for being willing to abandon the Medrash, he says, and now I'm going to abandon Rashi. I have also seen in his words, those of the other commentators, an unpaved road in explaining these verses, because all of them explain them without a proper connection to their contents, and so on. So he says, and I'm going to give you what's really going on, because he's Abarbanel, and that's what he does. So now flip the page, please. When I'm stuck with a chapter like this that I just don't know what to do with, what I like to do is try to go through the commentaries and map out where they go and where their points of difference are. Where are the differences between the approaches? Because what you can then do, if you can identify their general view of the chapter, and I'm going to go through this specifically in a moment, and you can figure out where they deviate, what you can also figure out are, what are the key questions in this parak? Instead of the key question being, I don't understand this, it'll become, in sentence 10, is that a question or a statement? The word yasafto, which is repeated in that sentence, does it mean the same thing the first time and the second time, or is it actually two different words, and Yeshaya is playing with language? Once you see where they give you different answers, you can start to understand what the right questions are to ask about the chapter, and that can help you then to come up with a line of attack. So what I show you here is Rashi and Radak have a view of this chapter that is more or less the same. It's not really the same. There are some fine points where they're distinct from each other, but I didn't want to start confusing things. So I lumped them together, and I hope they forgive me for doing so. Their approach to the chapter is as follows. It begins with an appeal to God to take care of us, to Jerusalem to welcome us in. It continues with a statement of our reliance on God, with confidence that God is going to reward us for our loyalty as well. He is going to punish those who had harmed us. He's going to reward those who are loyal. It has a prayer for Triat HaMeitim, for the ultimate resurrection of the dead. And the concluding lines are God promising us the end is nigh. So if you take a look quickly at the chapter itself, within 994, 995, right? So you see the opening sentences. Bayom hahu yushar hashir hazed. This song is going to be sung on that day. We're going to talk about what song it is. Be'eretz Yehuda, in the land of Judea, ir az lanu. Ir az lanu, this city is strong, or this strong city, depending on how you take that, there's debate. For us, this city, I'm jumping to sentence two, pitchu sharim, open up, O gates of this city. V'yavo goy tzadik shomer emunim. This righteous, loyal nation is going to enter the city. That's what we are looking for. And look now at Pasuk Dalid. Bitchu v'ashem ade'ad ki beka Hashem tzur olamim. Right? Familiar with us from the davening. But it's a call to the nation to trust in Hashem. That's what you're seeing here. We are asking God, we are asking Yerushalayim to take care of us. There is a call for us to be loyal. That continues with a song about how loyal we were over time. And then jump to the next page. You see how art school does it all as a poem until you get sentence 20? They think this whole thing is a poem about our loyalty and what God is going to do for us, and then our appeal to God. And then in sentence 20, God responds in this read of Rashi and Radak. Lech ami bo b'chadarecha. Go, my nation, into your rooms. I remember I was in Israel during the first Gulf War when we had to go into the sealed rooms during the Scud attacks. So this was one of the psukim that everybody quoted at the time. Go into your rooms. Skored latcha ba'adecha. Close your doors before you. Chavi, right? Lehe chave, to hide. Chavi kim'at rega ad ya'avor zam. Wait just a moment until the anger passes. Ki ne Hashem yotzei mimekomo lifkod avon yoshev ha'aretz alav. Hashem is going to leave his place in order to punish the dwellers of the land for their sins. Dot, dot, dot. And then on that day, the first pasuk in the next chapter, I believe, should be read as part of chapter 26. On that day, Yifkod Hashem b'charbo ha'kashava ha'gdolava ha'chazaka, God is going to bring his great sword against the Leviathan. Leviathan nachash bariach and Leviathan nachash akalaton. and he's going to kill the Tanin in the sea. But understand why I insist that that fits with chapter 26. What is the Leviathan for? Well, how do they usually talk about the Leviathan? Olam Haba. What about it? They're a big feast, right? That's what people usually take it as. But that's not what it means. The Mefarshim, the commentators, speak with one voice about this. Because you missed the way it connects back to chapter 26. This is a reference to, we'll see it in the commentators shortly, but this is a reference to the kings of those nations who had harmed you. God is going to bring his cherev against the Leviathan, Nachash Bariach, Leviathan, Nachash Akalaton. He's going to kill the Tanin Asher Bayam, which we usually understand to be Mitzrayim, to be Egypt. We'll talk about that. But that's the ending of this chapter. It's when God promises there will be a Triat HaMetim, there will be this reward / punishment that will go with it. So Rashi and Radak have a very simple read of the chapter. It starts out with an appeal to God to take care of us. Then you have, we should rely on God. You see it there in the shaded box. God is going to bring the wicked low. He's going to reward those who are loyal. Please, God, make this happen. And God replies, just be patient. It's going to happen. He's going to kill the Nachash, this Leviathan. Now, the reason I shaded that box that's in sentences 4 to 19, that key passage, is because that's the passage where you see the major difference between Rashi and Radak and Abarbanel and Malbim. But because they break up the chapter a little differently, it gets shifted downward in the table. Abarbanel and Malbim have a very similar read. I broke them out separately, but I'm going to lump them together right now, and then you'll see where they do differ from each other later. Abarbanel and Malbim agree regarding the beginning. It is a call to Jerusalem, or according to Malbim, a call to Jerusalem and to something called peace, called Shalom. Welcome us in. The next section there, sentences 3 to 6 or 4 to 6, depending on what you do with sentence 3. But the Abarbanel and the Malbim take it as not a statement of we should rely on God. It is a call to God to reform us, to make us rely on him, and to bring us peace. And Yeshaya says, Bitru, you should trust. That's Abarbanel. Or Malbim says, it's a statement from God, don't call to the city, call to me. Put your trust, bitchu b'Hashem, put your trust in God. But it is a call to us to be loyal, and maybe we're asking God for help in reforming us that we will be loyal, but then take a look at the shaded boxes in Abarbanel and Malbim. Here we turn to God and we say, God, you are righteous, we know you're great, but why is it that we are loyal to you and we suffer so in our exile? And why is it that the nations who are wicked and have done terrible things are thriving? And then Abarbanel adds in, what good is Triat HaMeitim? What good is a future redemption for the people who die now? Right? This is a classic question. Jews have asked this for a very long time. When I read this in Abarbanel, my thought was autobiographical much, right? Abarbanel living through the expulsions from the Iberian Peninsula, right? Seeing how people suffered. Abarbanel says that's the question that's being asked here of God. It don't read this chapter as a statement of God, we have been loyal. It's an attack. It's God, we've been loyal. Where have you been? That's the way that Abarbanel reads it. That's the way that Malbim reads it as well. Again, with some slight variation between them. So that Malbim says that one line is to be read as, you know, God, I understand. You don't want to be visible to everybody because then there wouldn't be any free will. I get it. But really, we've had enough. That's the, Malbim throws that in there. And then, once they get through that section, you get to the end and God's reply. So God's reply, according to Abarbanel, is, don't worry, the righteous who died are coming back in Triat HaMeitim. They will indeed receive reward for what they did. Malbim, sort of similar, you see it there in the column. But ultimately, don't worry, reward and punishment are near. So what you see here, and what I'm trying to show here, is that they're not that different, the commentators. The main difference is only this question in the middle. The question of, is this a statement of our loyalty, or is this a challenge to God for our loyalty? But you're beginning with a plea to let this loyal nation return into the city. A little bit of difference after that from Barbanel and Malbim, but I'm not going to dwell on it. Then you get the central section of either a statement of our loyalty or a challenge based on our loyalty. And then you conclude with a promise from God. You follow? I think when you map it out, if you just do that over and over again, like read it over and over again, eventually you start to understand what it is that they're doing. And as I said, to notice the points where they deviate from each other. One note, I did want to bring you in number 6,
yeah,
was just to show you that opening sentence in chapter 27. Remember, we are not responsible for the chapter breaks. That didn't come from us. That's a Christian thing. So I feel no guilt whatsoever saying that 27:1 belongs with chapter 26. Look at what Abarbanel says here. In the interest of time, I'm going to just read out my translation. I have no doubt, he says, that it is talking about Rome and Yishmael. One of them is the snake who extends from one end to the other, Yishmael, who reigns over most of human civilization. That's the Leviathan that is called Nachash Bariach, meaning it is Mavriach, it races, right? To be Boreach is to flee. It races from one end to the other. So that's the Islamic empire of his day. And it calls Rome, and it calls Rome Nachash Akalaton. Akalaton is to be crooked, because it is crooked, mi'ukal in its deeds. That's the way he views Rome. Keep in mind, of course, he suffered a great deal at the hands of Rome. As if to say that even though God shows favor to Rome and Yishmael now due to the sins of Israel, and therefore they have become great to the point of being like the Leviathan, the great serpent, but at that time God will bring upon them his harsh sword to destroy them. Also, he notes, there was a third being mentioned in the sentence, the Tanin Asher Bayam. So he says, the other kings of the land who are not of their faiths or multitudes, they're not Muslim, they're not Christian, who are at the ends of civilization, he says, kind of Eurocentric view of the world, he will destroy. And so it says he will kill the Tanin in the sea. Rashi explained the three Taninim mentioned in this verse as Assyria, Egypt, and Rome. Whatever it is. The prophet says that Hashem will take his revenge against the nations and destroy them. I don't particularly care what their names are. That's his verdict. But that's where I get the idea that 27:1 should really be read with chapter 26. It's really the cap of that prophecy. So what I want to show you now is once you have your major theme and once you see your points of difference, which we didn't really highlight yet, I'm going to, you watch how all the points of difference play out depending on how you took the major theme within the chapter. This is really like when someone learns in yeshiva and you go to a shir that's called an iyun shir. Iyun is fine analysis. So classic model for a shir bi'iyun, when you want to learn something in a gemara shir or in a halacha shir, is you look at the major distinction between two ideas, and then you show how, depending on which idea you adopt, that has ramifications about other things, other debates, other discussions. Also, I'll give you one of my favorite examples from my Rebbe in grade 9 in MTA, Rabbi Yitzhak Cohn. This was not his shir. This is Rabbi Yonason Sachs, who I had in grade 11, who's now the head of the yeshiva in Touro. So he gave a shir every year on a Sunday. I think it was like the Sunday before Purim or something. I don't remember anymore what the occasion was. But it was the same shir. Like that was the shir for that day. You knew coming in. When they had a deal at Carvel, maybe not the best thing for a fast day, they on Wednesdays, so you could get, it was Wednesday is Sunday at Carvel, so you buy one, get one free. And the question is, when you buy one, get one free, does that mean you're getting two half price each? Or is the first one the one you paid for and the second one is free? And you look at me and say, what kind of distinction is that? Why does that matter? So one of the applications is, let's say I went on a date with a girl to a Carvel and it was Wednesday and we got the two Sundays and I paid and I got these two Sundays and I took one for myself and I gave her the other one and I said the Hare At and gave it to her as a Kiddushin formulation. If you say that it is 50% off, but it has value to it. On the other hand, if you say that it's free, then it has no value. I mean, it has value because it's ice cream. That's not a discussion. But you understand what the answer that you give has halachic applications in a whole bunch of other areas. And his shir was basically to go through all the ramifications that would flow from that. Applying that here, one read is the read of Rashi and Radak, which is, this is a chapter about how we've been loyal and God is ultimately going to bring schar va'onesh, reward and punishment, on that basis. However, Abarbanel and Malbim say no. This is a chapter of challenge, of appealing to God and saying, we've been loyal and for what? And depending on how you read the chapter, that will answer some of the key questions about how to read the chapter. Take a look at the bottom table on the second side. I gave you a brief outline of what the differences are within the chapter and how each side is going to give a different view of what we of how to read them. So the first difference in the chapter is the song, right? We began the chapter by saying that there is some kind of a song that is going to be sung on that day. Well, what exactly is this song? So the song is clearly a song of loyalty. That's clear. It's a song of loyalty and saying that God is trustworthy. However, Rashi and Radak are going to say that song runs the entire chapter until you get to God's response in sentence 20, which is why the Art Scroll structures the whole thing in poem form in their translation. Abarbanel and Malbim disagree. Challenging God, saying we've been loyal, that's not a song. So they say the song ends earlier. Flip the page. Yeah, flip the page. Take a look at source number 7. Radak says, on sentence 19, where we're told, then at the time of salvation your dead will live, we already wrote at the start of this portion that this song will be sung on that day. The song is this portion until this verse, all the way till sentence 19. Whereas Malbim in number 8, Abarbanel is the same, but I brought you Malbim because he stated it explicitly, says on sentence 6, which is the end of the statement that God is in fact trustworthy, he says the song is until here. From here on, the prophet pours out his feelings before God, praying regarding the tranquility of the wicked, the suffering of the righteous. Your song stops in sentence 6. It all depends on how you read the chapter. Then you get to sentences 7 and 8. And here I want to pause in looking at the differences. I didn't even bring this on the sheet, but I should have probably brought it on the sheet, but I didn't. Take a look at sentences 7 and 8 and page 995. The way of uprightness is for the righteous. O upright one, straighten the circuit of the righteous. Even on the path of your judgments, Hashem, we put our hopes in you, your name and your mention, the yearning of our soul. This sounds really like what Rashi is saying, right? This sounds a lot like Rashi's view, Rashi Radak's view of the chapter. God is wonderful, we should be loyal. It doesn't seem to fit with the read of Abarbanel and Malbim. So what Malbim does here is he says to you, you know what this is? This is an apology for what's coming. He says, sentence 7 is, I'm going to read you out of the Malbim text. He says, two different things. Yeah. He says, where was it? Unless I confuse my Malbim with my Abarbanel, which can happen. No. He says, Ukumoshinagu kol hachozim, as all the prophets did. Be'ez dabro al ha'sheila zos, when he spoke about this question of why are the righteous people suffering, why are the wicked people thriving, she'nichu t'chila li'yesod musad, they first established a foundation, ki vaday darchei Hashem tovim ma'od, that for sure God's ways are good, rak she'ra'uy la'asos kein k'dei she'lo yezos mechshol l'bnei adam l'asuray de'kach mi'darchei Hashem. But then they challenge and say, but then God, you should act in a way that we see as just, because otherwise people are going to stray from your ways. So he then goes into examples about Tehillim and in Yirmiyahu, where someone who's going to challenge God first begins by saying, God, I know you're great. And that's what's going on here in sentences 7 and 8. Before the challenge, he says, God, I know you are righteous. He also points out something else. As he reads the chapter, Yeshaya does not complain about the suffering of the tzaddikim as much as he complains about the thriving of the wicked. And Malbim explains why. He says, Lo eshala yisurei tzaddikim. I didn't bring this on your sheets. He said, I'm not going to ask about the suffering of the righteous. Because the answer to this is, quite frankly, obvious. The answer to this is fairly clear. Why? Because, you know, God doesn't necessarily see the things that you see. He doesn't look with your eyes. You may think somebody is righteous, but in fact, you don't know what goes on behind closed doors. Right, all the times that you read in the newspapers that they found out that someone was doing something horrible, and all the friends and all the associates say, we can't believe it. Who would have ever guessed? We never would have known. And then, you know, in days to come, you find out exactly who knew, and, you know, he's on trial now. But there's so many times people think somebody is good, and they don't know. So he says, I'm not going to bother you, God, about that. You tell me someone has to suffer because they deserve it, I'm not interested in bothering you. But he says, that doesn't answer the question of Madua Derech Reshaim Tzlecha. Why is it that the wicked are succeeding? Halo HaRasha Rishato Gluya Meforsemet. Everybody can see how bad this guy is. The V'yev Shalomar Shut Tzadik Umadu Matzlech. Don't tell me he's a tzadik. You can't say that. Why is he thriving? Now, you could always tell one of these classic Hasidic stories about the fellow who everybody thinks is a bad guy, and then he dies, and then all the people who suddenly were receiving staka from him are no longer receiving staka from him, and I get it. No, I'm reading the news. But Malbim's point is to try to explain that why the emphasis here is not on God, we have been righteous, we've been loyal, therefore reward us. It's God, we've been loyal and we've suffered, punish them. And he says it's because we can't claim necessarily that we're perfect, but we know a bad guy when we see one. That's what he says. So the opening part of the song, is about loyalty. And again, Rashi and Radak said it continues to be about our loyalty. As far as Malbim and Abarbanel are concerned, it's not so. Even if it begins with a statement of God, I know you are just, it leads into a challenge. Take a look at sentences 10 and 11, please. That's our next stop on this. 10 and sticking with 10, even before you get to 11. Okay? Yuchan Rasha Balamad Tzedek. So, again, the art scroll here renders it along the lines of Rashi and Radak's school. Shall grace be granted the wicked one? Sorry, hang on. Is he reading it along their lines? Hold on one second, please. No, he's not. Interesting. He's reading it with Radak. He's not reading it with Rashi. Okay, that's good to know. Someone who listens to the Shir online actually emailed me a while back saying that Art Scroll on Navi is not necessarily following with Rashi. He's right here. It's not with Rashi, it's Radak. That's interesting. Rashi and Radak have different approaches, and Malbim has yet another approach. Let's read the sentence first. Let's confuse things after. Yuchan Rasha, Yuchan from Chain, to receive favor. Yuchan Rasha Balamad Tzedek. So he's reading it as Radak reads it. It's a question. Yuchan Rasha, should the wicked person be given chen? Should he be given favor? Balamad tzedek, when he doesn't learn righteousness. Why should that person be rewarded? That's the way that Radak reads it. If you take a look at source number 10 on the sheet, I brought it for you there. The wicked will receive favor in shock. He says, shall the wicked receive favor? He has not learned justice for your law. The nations say the punishments are not instruction, but are happenstance. Why in the world should they receive favor? That's the way that Radak reads that sentence as a question. Rashi reads it as a statement in source number 9. The wicked will receive favor in the land of justice, Jerusalem and the temple. He's referring to what you see in the text inside that we didn't read out loud. He will act corruptly, despoiling and destroying. He will not see divine greatness. He doesn't value your greatness in his eyes. Rashi reads it as a statement. And then you get Abarbanel. And Abarbanel and Malbim, I brought you my Abarbanel in number 11, are stronger. Is it appropriate and right that the wicked should receive mercy and favor? The one who has never learned justice, who acts corruptly in the land of justice, Israel, who performs chamas and does not praise your might? It's a challenge to God. So, again, what I'm trying to show, and I realize it's hard to do this way, but I'm doing the best I can with it because I think it's worthwhile, is depending on how, well, the fundamental point is sentence 10 is vague. Yuchan Rasha Balamad Tzedek, the wicked receives favor, he hasn't learned righteousness, is a hard phrase. Rashi and Radak will take it one way, even if Rashi and Radak differ in how exactly to do it. Abarbanel and Malbim will read it the other way. Rashi and Radak will read it as part of a poem about how loyal we've been despite everything that's happened. Abarbanel and Malbim read it as a challenge to God. How could you allow this to happen? I'm jumping to sentence 14. This one may be easier than sentences 10 and 11 because it is. Sentence 14. Mesim bal yichyu, rifaim bal yakumu. They're dead, they will not live. Rifaim, they translate here as lifeless.
As what?
Lifeless, they render it here. It's ghosts, rifaim. Okay. Shades, spirits of the dead. Yeah. Bal yakumu, they will not rise again. Who are the dead who don't come back to life? So Rashi and Radak, right, see number 12? Rashi says this is talking about the wicked people. Mason Baliachu, the dead will not live. You punish them. You destroy them with your mouth's order. Radak says it refers to the idols of the nations, the gods of those nations to whom we didn't turn in exile, for they are dead and they have no substance. They shall not live. They have no life. They are as the dead. Contrast that with Malbim. Abarbanel as well, but I brought you Malbim here. He says, no, this is a challenge to God. It's talking about the tzaddikim who died and saying to God, is it appropriate that because they sanctified your name, they should die forever? It's a challenge. Mesim bal yichyu, rifaim bal yakumu, really? That's the way that Abarbanel reads it. That's the way that that Malbim reads it as well. It's a challenge. And then you get to sentence 15, which is one of the most beautiful sentences you can find. But it's so hard to read. Yasafta lagoy Hashem, yasafta lagoy nichbadita. What does yasafta mean? Don't read the English. What does yasafta mean?
To add on.
So one way to read it is like lahosif, to add. What else could it be? What else could it be? What other word do you see within that word?
Sof.
An end, to bring an end to something. And it's Yasafta Legoy Hashem. What does the word goy mean?
Nation.
Who? Which nation?
Depends.
Sometimes it refers to the world. Sometimes it refers to non-Jews as opposed to Jews. And sometimes it refers to us. Right? In the beginning of this parak, it referred to us. Goy Tzadik Shomer Amunim. It was us. So which one is it here? How do you read this sentence? Yeshaya is having too much fun with language, and I don't know what he means. Yasabta l'goy Hashem, yasabta l'goy nechbarata. I don't know what you're talking about. So that's our challenge. So Rashi and Radak read it as being about the elevation of the Jews, but in two different ways. And I think to try to make it clear, I'll say it outside of their text and hope that that helps. But I brought you the text on the sheet in case you want to try it that way.
Exalted, or how are you getting that through your subject?
Sorry, I didn't say anything yet.
Oh, you didn't? No, like you just said this. Okay.
No. The way that Rashi reads it is that both Yasavtas are about the greatness that God gave to the Jews, which led to honor for God. So it's a poetic repetition. Yasafta, you added for us. You gave us great things. You gave us Torah, you gave us mitzvot, you gave us honor. It's number 15 if you're reading the Rashi on the sheet. You gave great things to the nation, to the Jews, Hashem. Yasafta lagoy, you added to us, and therefore nichbarata, therefore you were honored. We honored you. That's the way that Rashi reads it. Radak says, and if you flip, you'll see it in number 16. Radak says the word goy means two different things in this sentence. Radak reads it as, Yasafta, you destroyed. You destroyed the goy, meaning the nations. Yasafta l'goy, you added to us, to your nation, nichbarata, and therefore you were elevated. And then Abarbanel and Malbim say, no, that's not what it's talking about at all. Abarbanel says, you destroyed the goy, meaning the Jews. And Yasafta, you elevated the goy, meaning the nations. Exact opposite. He inverted it. Yep, entirely. And he says, Nichbarata. But it's like, and Nichbarata is a question. Did that bring you honor God? Did that help you? Yes. Sorry?
So did Radak say that you destroy because of the stuff?
Yes.
And because you destroy, you added.
You asapta lagoy, you destroyed that nation.
Yeah.
Yasafta lagoy, you added to this nation, to the Jews.
The same word.
Yes.
Yes.
For both.
Correct. Because the Yeshaya does stuff like that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, we've seen Yeshaya do things like that. No. We've seen Yeshaya use the same word with two different meanings. Yes. Correct.
And the Radak is using that. You destroyed, you caused our end.
Yes.
By, and there you added.
No, what Radak says is, you destroyed the nations,
and
you elevated us. Right. Sorry. Yes. Yes. And Abarbanel says this anyway. You're right. Hashem always says, I haven't destroyed you. And that's going to become even more clear in the next parak. Hakamakat makeu ikahu. Right? We'll see it there. But that's absolutely what he's saying here. You'll see Abarbanel number 17. You can see it for yourself. But yes, Abarbanel flips Radak's approach on its head. You destroyed the goy, meaning the Jews. You elevated the goy, meaning the nations, and it's a question, did that bring you honor? And Malbim has a similar take. I'm going to leave him there. And then at the end, I'm skipping a little bit of material here just because we're hitting 2:30. But he's in sentence 19, he flips what he did in sentence 14. In 14, he said, the dead are not going to live, the ghosts are not coming back. Now he says, Yichyu meitacha, nevela si yikumun. Your dead will come back to life. My nevela, my corpse, yikumun, will rise up. Rashi says that this is the Jews speaking to God. Yichyu meitacha, your dead, the tzaddikim who died for you, God, are going to come back. It's part of our song to God. That's why Rashi reads it. Nevela si, my corpse, is meaning my dead. Radak here joins Abarbanel and Malbim and says, no, this is God speaking to us. Yichyu Meisecha, God says to the Jews, your dead, your tzaddikim, are going to come back to life. Nevelati, my corpses, those who died for me, Yikumun, are going to rise. That's the idea. So what I want to just do very quickly here, because I realize that it's 2:30. If we can stay for just a minute, I don't normally like to hold over, but I definitely don't want to keep this to next week. Yeshaya's audience for this prophecy, I think, has to be Jews who have really suffered. Like we said in the beginning, it's Galut Bavel. It's got to be. The key description of the Jews in this chapter is loyalty, right? That's what it's all about, is the fact that we're loyal to God. The key description of God in this chapter is right in the beginning, that he is supposed to be worthy of loyalty, but as Abarbanel and Malbim see it, he hasn't acted on it in any way that we have seen. The song in the chapter is the song about God's trustworthiness and our loyalty, but according to Rashi Radak, it goes through the chapter until God's response at the end. According to Abarbanel and Malbim, it stops at sentence 6. He talks about those who do not return to life. According to Rashi, that's the nations. According to Radak, it's the idols. According to Abarbanel and Malbim, this is the challenge. It's the tzaddikim. And then at the end, you're dead who return to life. Rashi says it means God's dead, the tzaddikim. Radak sides with Abarbanel and Malbim, saying Hashem is speaking to us. It is our dead, and they are the ones who are coming back to life. I didn't get to say everything I wanted to say on it. I hope you take the time to look through the sources and to see the table, which maybe gives a little bit more explanation. But I hope you got something out of it in terms of just like a way to deal with chapters like this. The best thing you can do is just read, reread, 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 and try to map out where the points of difference are, and that can really, that I find can be useful.
What is